Welcome to Breaking the Underdog Curse with Dr. Don McDonald. This show is for vitalistic chiropractors that want to take their practice to a new level. Whether that is higher volume, less stress, more congruency, or just want to continually learn and evolve. Every Wednesday, I will be bringing you an interview that will provide you with either mindset or strategies that will help you overcome your underdog curse. Whether you are plateaued, afraid to fail, or stressed out due to overwhelm, this podcast will show you how others have overcome their challenges. Make sure to go to www.drdonmcdonald.com where you can sign up to get notifications when new shows are released and see previous ones you may have missed. I hope you enjoy the show and don't forget to crush the curse. Are you a people pleaser? I know I sure am. And when you mix that with being a chiropractor, it can create a lot of trauma. I know firsthand, it can wear away at your health, your relationships, and your practice. I term this the underdog curse, and I've spent the last 15 years coming up with a solution. My book, The Underdog Curse, was written to help others live a more authentic life. This is very challenging if you're externally influenced. When you take an externally influenced person and have them try to spread the message of chiropractic, it can be very challenging. If you'd like to get back to who you really are, regain your health, strengthen your relationships, and increase your worthiness, please visit Amazon.com and pick up your copy of The Underdog Curse today. Remember, if we take the time to nurture ourselves, we are much stronger at serving others. For chiropractic to thrive, we must have thriving chiropractors. All right. Well, today I'm extremely excited to have our next guest. He's a great friend of ours. We just really got to know him really good in the last year. He is the president of the ICPA. He is the chair of the board at Sherman College of Chiropractic. He's also the chairman of the IFCO. He's been in practice, has an insane busy practice, super successful, been in practice for over 30 years. He travels almost every single weekend around the world, helping chiropractors, you know, grow their practice, helping people to help their patients and help everyone get healthier. So it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Peter Kevorkian to the Breaking the Underdog Curse podcast.
Awesome. Great to be here, Don.
That's awesome. So one of the goals of this podcast is just to kind of help the people out there listening who might have felt like an underdog, whether they're externally in a situation where they're underdog or feeling internal as an underdog. And what I like to do is find people who have succeeded in their life and really excelled above the pack and kind of dig into their brain and kind of figure out what are their challenges they've been growing up and when they've experienced that feeling as well. Because Dr. Peter, have you always been this successful?
Well, you know, I guess Don begins by saying, what does success really mean?
Exactly. And what does it mean to you?
So when somebody says, I want to have success in my life, part of it is defining what success is in a person's life. You know, I know lots of people who have lots and lots of money who are very unhappy people. So on a certain level, they may be successful in a business, but they're not successful as a human being. I also know some people who have no money and barely have two nickels to rub together who are not happy. You know, and those people are, I don't consider them successful either. So money is not an attribute of success. I also know people who live in a state of bliss sometimes in their own mind, but yet don't have the ability to influence the world the way they want to or other people. So I don't know if they're successful either. So I think success is really defined by what it is for a person, you know, and what it is. And I think there are many pieces that have to come together in a person's life to truly say objectively they're successful. There's, you know, the various aspects of your existence physically, you know, mm-hmm. that is a part of success. I think some of it may be the social skills, being able to integrate socially at a point that allows you to be happy. Family, having your relationships in your lives, a business. But a lot of it is a person getting clear on what are their individual values. You know, what is important in their lives and are they able to attain that? You know, if a person's greatest value is family and raising productive, healthy, self-determined children, and that's their greatest value in their life, then they could say they're successful. If they've had kids and those kids are off doing what they can do in their own lives. If a person says that their success is, you know, owning a multi-million dollar, multi-billion dollar corporation, I guess I could say that that's success in their lives. So I guess if you're going to turn it to me and says, what's success in Peter's life? I love getting up in the morning and excited to be alive, feeling that what I'm going to do in a given day is going to make a difference in my life, in my family's life, and in the lives of people who I influence and touch. And I like having a good time in that process. So in that level, I consider myself very successful. And to go back to your first question, have I always been successful? I think I've always strived for that. And I guess ever since I was a little kid, there's a part of me that wanted to get up every day and be excited, be happy to be alive, and know that I can make a difference in the world. And I can honestly say over the last 10 years, I've probably been able to say, yeah, I've done that. And I think the manner in which I became clear that I became successful is a conversation I had with a good friend of mine a few years ago. And I said, you know, if my creator called me tomorrow and said, it's time, you know, your job is done. You're coming home, however you want to view that.
Yeah.
I feel complete. You know, I feel like I've raised kids that are self-sufficient, self-determined, productive in their own lives. I've had meaningful relationships in my life. I've been able to have what I consider very impactful practice, chiropractic practice. I've been able to influence other professionals to go on a path that they can find their own truth. I've experienced a spiritual awakening in my life in various ways. I've enjoyed things physically in my body. I'm a happy guy. So on that level, I guess I'm successful. Always been that way. I think I've always strived for it. And you know what? I got up this morning saying, okay, what can I do to make it better? You know, so I'm constantly on that journey of in life to not feel stagnant, to feel like, oh, I've arrived. You know, I'm always working to say, well, what can be better about my practice? We're in the process of rebranding and refocusing that. What can I do to make your impact into the profession? You know, whether it's at the college the board that I'm on or the organizations. What can I do to develop myself, my physicality, my well-being, my health and vitality? So Don, yeah, it's a journey. I don't know if you ever hit that destination.
No, that's 100%. And I think too, like one of the premises when I wrote the book too is exactly that, is to define what success is on your own. And a lot of times people are defining their success based on external factors or what other people expect of them. And I was just wondering, throughout your life, had you ever had any challenges where you had to kind of have that conflict between what you truly would want? Because first of all, it's hard to find out what you truly want, right? For some people, they don't know what their purpose is. And then how do you balance that with like the three saboteurs I talk about is internal, which would be in your brain, like the way you think like you're not worth it, or external would be like where you live, or maybe you grew up with lack or without those resources, or the intimate saboteurs too, where it might've been relationships that you've had that are close. We always call those bonds that are close, like those close five or six people towards you. Sometimes they can take you away from your purpose too. So I was wondering, through your growing up or 20s or 30s, have you ever had the challenge with that, balancing your purpose with absolutely that?
So my greatest one was probably that first one, the internal one. You know, as I was growing up, and I don't think I'm unique in this, very often you set your targets in your life to make your parents happy. And you know, I had to be the good boy, you know, behave a certain way, act a certain way, and fit within a certain role. And I think I'm unique to that. I think that a lot of people fall in that place and don't necessarily come from your own authenticity of who you are as a being, but who your parents believe you're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. My nature was to be extremely introverted. I was always geekish before it was popular to be a geek. I was never part of the social group growing through grammar school, high school. I had one, two really close friends. I was never the one that they were always like, run to be first. I never want to be in the limelight. But, you know, every kid wants to be acknowledged, but I never wanted to be out in the front because I might be wrong.
Right.
So I tend to be rather introverted. And during my time in college, particularly undergraduate school, I went to college to become an engineer, which tends to be a very rather introverted.
Yeah.
If you want to joke, you know how you can tell an extroverted engineer?
How?
That's the person who's looking at the other person's shoes when they're talking to you. There's more key to that than you know.
Yeah. Okay.
I looked at my own.
Mm.
So when I was in engineering school, again, I wasn't the most social person, but as engineers are an interesting breed of people. As I would look at the world around me, I said, is this really how I want to live my life? You know, because I would see people doing things, acting things, experiencing things that, damn, I would have, I like that. But I can't do that in this role, doing what I want. Then when I chose to go to chiropractic school, which was a huge step for me because it definitely pushed that area that I was just talking about with my parents, because that did not fit within their paradigm. You know, go to school, graduate, you get a job, you get a family, you live your life. So I chose to become a chiropractor, and you know, my father thought that they were charlatans.
Yeah.
You know, his first question was, can you make any money doing that? You know, that. And so I had to, there's a part of me that had to find my own power and just say, yeah, this is what I want to do and this is why I want to do it. And this is how I can make a difference in the world, which I think ever since I was a little kid, I always felt like there's a reason I was put here to be in this body, in this life, in this time, in this place. And I had to make a difference. And when I found chiropractic, or it found me, I knew that this was my path. So then as I started to chiropractic school, again, you know, sitting in a room with 168 people, Palmer College, and I'm an introvert. It's like, oh my gosh, can I handle this? And a life-changing moment happened my first day in chiropractic school. And the person gets up and does a lay lecture, an old Reggie Gold lecture with lecture charts. And in the 15, 20 minutes that he talked and told the chiropractic story, the first time that I really heard the story from start to finish, I had tears in my eyes and I said, oh my God, that person just changed my life because I got it. I got that big idea that we talk about as chiropractors. And I said to myself, I'm going to learn how to do that. I'm going to do that. And a shy little boy, you can barely, you'll talk to somebody, and I'm going to get up in front of a group of people and talk. So that started my journey, and I had to find ways, if that's what I wanted, and that's the effect, the influence that I want to make on other people through that means, that mechanism, that I needed to deal with a part of me that held me back, that underdog that you referred to, mm-hmm. which in this case was my introvert. And so mm-hmm. I would have conversations with my introvert. And actually learned that he had a personality that was there. And that Peter actually had lots of different personalities. There's a Peter that wanted to get up and do talks. There's a Peter that wanted to be a doctor, a caregiver. There's a Peter that wanted to be the good boy. There's a Peter that wanted to be the shy little boy sitting in the corner. But that shy little boy who always wanted to sit in the corner, if that's the person who was in my front, on the front, I'd never be able to get up and group people and talk. I'd never really be able to make the degree of influence that I believed that I could make. And so I would start watching people and seeing people who were doing things that I said, I want to be able to do that. And I said, how can I do that? So I modeled people. You know, I saw people like Reggie Gold.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm going to do what he does. I'm going to use the same words. I'm going to use the same phrases. I figure if I can do what he does, I'll be able to do what he does, right? Mm-hmm. Joe Felicia, a huge mentor of mine. I just can do what he does. And so I went to like a gazillion Renaissance seminars. I don't even know what they are, but there was a guy him and Guy Reichman had a program called Renaissance, focused on patient education and building the value of chiropractic in the minds of the chiropractor as well as patients. So I just started modeling them. And as I was doing that, that little introvert would always come up and say, oh, you look like a goof. Oh, my God. Did you? Oh, my God. Listen to that audio. You sound like a whatever. And so I said, damn, I can't have this conflict going on. How can I make that influence if I'm beating the crap out of myself all the time? Mm-hmm. And so my means of, and I've told you this, is like I wound up making an agreement with the little introvert inside of me. And he's anytime that I'm going to be in front of a group of people, particularly speaking in front of a group of people, I make that guy just sit up in the corner of my brain. I said, you can sit up here and watch. And after I'm done, you can talk. But until that time, you don't have permission to say anything. Because if I'm going to pull this off, and I literally felt like I was going on stage. If I'm going to pull this off, I said, you can't talk to me because all you do is screw me up, right? so that was a system, that a means of coping that I developed while I was in school to be able to get up and begin to talk to people in a group. But anytime I go to a party or in a social environment, the introvert was always still in the front. I'd like sit in the corner and I'd see other guys like dating women and able to engage. And I said, damn, I want to be able to do that. So I had to talk to an introvert as I'm going through college now and saying, well, you're going to sit over there when I'm here at this party. And I literally had to like watch people, model people, and figure out until I can make that my own. Am I making any sense in all of this?
100%. Because how did you know that? Like, did you, have your first couple of opportunities to speak, and did you have a hard time with it? And tell me a good story of when we did one of your first talks.
Okay. So what I'm doing, I'm at Palmer College, and part of at that time there was a philosophy and communications club. And so I'd go there, and one of the things we were all trying to do is to do an effective patient lecture. And yeah. You know, videos, they didn't have video cassettes. This was reel to reel movies that we watch. Okay. So, I'm old, man. You know, I'm 60. Watching these movies back then and trying to learn from people who had gone before, who'd done it. And I said, the only way that I'm ever going to do this is to do it. So I took a script. It was an old lecture created by Joe Felicia and Guy Riekman, a Renaissance lecture. There were 13 to 14 charts that all talked about chiropractic, health, subluxation, causes, etc. And I got 15 of my friends together in the library at Palmer College. There was a meeting room there.
Yeah.
I set it up like a lecture, and I had my lecture charts, and my roommate, I'll never forget, my roommate is sitting like right in the front row, right? And they're like a dozen, maybe up to 20, a dozen people in the room, some people who go to the philosophy club and whatnot, but I'm there doing the lecture, and I'll never forget Tom, my roommate, sitting right in the front row. He says, yeah, man, when you turn that chart to look at the cause, to talk about the cause of someone's age, you look like you were going to die. Yeah, I was. So it's literally putting myself right in the fire, you know, right in a place that was very uncomfortable. You know,
yeah.
That I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to pull it off. And if I could give it an example, I literally have to memorize a script. And the entire time that I'm doing the talk, there are a group of people in front of me, but it's like that script was between them and me.
You know, right.
I'm literally like reading it in my mind. You know, it's not that I have pages reading it, but like it was in my mind. I probably did that for a dozen times, maybe 20 times before the script actually went down and said, holy shit, there are people there. And then I really realized that, yes, I'm saying these words, but those words now begin to land on people and they respond, react to those words. Mm-hmm. And that's really when I began to learn how to speak to a group of people. Is the script was gone. The words were there. I didn't need to think about what I was going to say any longer, but I got to witness how people reacted to those words. Mm-hmm. And then I began to work on how I presented. And I could actually learn that process at this point. Where do you stand? Where do you put your hands? How do you move in the room? And how do you then develop your skill as an effective communicator in that setting? Mm-hmm. And literally, that's how I've done this whole process. It's like the introvert goes, sits up here. I figure out what I'm going to say. Then I go do it. And as I'm doing it, it's like watching a movie. Okay. But the introvert has no input to the movie until we're sitting at home watching what had happened. And it still happens today. So when I'm teaching for ICPA, those first few minutes right before I start teaching, even though I've done this dozens of times, I literally have a conversation with the introvert to go up in that spot. And I say, you can sit up here. I set my anchors, where I'm going to do. And literally, it's like walking on stage and doing it. But now, it's not just doing and reading a script, but it's engaging in an intimate relationship with the people that I'm communicating with. Watching how my words, my actions, my intention, my passion, my articulation lands on people. Seeing how their physiology changes. Seeing how they are processing that. And you develop your skill in being able to say, oh, wow, I really hit the edge of a belief system. You could see how a person wasn't really there. And then how can I dance around that so they can begin to see my idea and not be resistant to it? Mm-hmm. So it's been a whole process, Don, you know, of getting there. Overcoming that introvert was a key factor in me learning the skill to get there. And rather than using the word overcome, because I don't think that there's an overcoming this, because he's still very much there.
Yeah.
But it's learning how to develop a relationship with him that didn't interfere with me being able to make the difference that I want to make in people's lives and in their right. communication. It's the same process that's happened in literally everything, because as you know me, my whole goal is about relationships and people and connecting with people. but I can't let the introvert get in the way of me developing a relationship with somebody and being able to have them see a perspective and an idea, an approach, a philosophy, an ideology, whatever it is, so that that can land on them and that they can take it in their own lives. Mm-hmm. Whether that be on a board or be in the ICPA or be teaching or be in any other group that I influence.
That's awesome. Well, that's cool. So basically it's like do it over and over again and just kind of tweak it and tweak it. And it's almost like creating a whole new neural pathway in your brain.
That's exactly right. It really is. You know, it's giving yourself permission to go there and, and finding a way to get there, finding a means of coping to get there. Because there are some people that are truly extroverts, you know, that have other issues within their lives that are not issues for me at all. But it's finding a means for me to handle that aspect of me that I felt like was inhibiting my development, my growth, my ability to impact the world. And when you were reading, when I read your book, that's what continually came up for me, is that was my underdog, if you will. And on a certain level, I can say my gift. You know, we tend to look at that as being what holds us back. In many ways, it's exactly the thing that you need to propel you to where you need to go. Mm-hmm. Fear is a major obstacle within people's lives. You know, we tend to shun away from our fears, whether the fears of the external world, external things to do, or internal processes. The universe is a way to continually test us and allow those fears to come before us. Growth happens when you're able to not be disempowered by fear, but taking that fight or flight response and allow it to empower you to move through fear. So I don't view fear as a negative, as many people do. I actually view it as a gift. It, if we listen to it, we listen to our physiology, that the fears very often, which are our underdogs, which are our not goodness, which are our insecurities, you know, all of those things that come before us, they become opportunities for us to grow and to develop our sense of authenticity in our lives.
So if you were to have a conversation with someone and someone was, you know, if you've probably had this because you've helped to coach a lot of people and help a lot of people get through some of these, but if someone feels like they're paralyzed with fear and like, how do they go from being paralyzed by fear to using fear, like you just explained, to use that as fuel? Do you have any insights on how people could kind of take the first few steps with that?
Yeah, there are three basic steps that I believe you confront fear with. Mm-hmm. First step is to breathe. Because when we confront fearful situations, we stop breathing in every way. Okay, yes, the breath that we take into our lungs, but we don't move within our lives. So you need to consciously breathe. And sometimes to consciously breathe means to exercise. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that is, I was in a very, very, very stressful time in my life a number of years ago. And it was a time I was doing martial arts. Damn, I hit that bag harder than ever. Right? So breathing is a key part of facing fear. And sometimes you have to force your breath, you know, sometimes because as you engage in situation, you tend to hold your breath, you know, your breath becomes very, very shallow. Second thing I feel is to be in gratitude and to come into a state of overwhelming gratitude for everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to look at the joys that you have in your life, the wins that you have in your life, the wonderful things that you have in your life, whether it be family, relationships, lifestyle, experiences, whatever they are, but to find a way to also be in gratitude for your challenges. Because those challenges are those areas of growth. And then that was a major shift in my mind that I said, what's the gift here? You know, what is this allowing me to feel? What is this allowing me to become sensitive to? And sometimes you can't always figure it out, okay? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't. And you get angry and you get remorseful. You feel victimized. But I guess I believe our fundamental major premise to our profession, that there's intelligence in the universe and everything. That intelligence just doesn't hold computers together and bodies together and let the roots grow down and the trees grow up and the rug be a rug and the wall be a wall. But that intelligence that holds the universe together architects every life experience just the way it's supposed to be. That everything that I call joyful and wonderful is architected by the universe as everything that I call remorseful or sorrowful or fearful. Yeah. So to come into a state that the whatever is occurring in my life, that there, I can find a degree of gratitude, even if the gratitude is me being able to surrender to the experience and trust, right? Mm-hmm. In gratitude for it. And the third thing is to actually see that which you want. See the product. See yourself on the other side, accomplishing whatever it is. In the story that I told you, being up in front of a group of people, successfully delivering a talk, message, class, whatever it is, and then seeing, feeling, smelling, tasting, touching the applause, the hugs afterwards, the acknowledgments, the you're knowing that I'm going to get a letter or a card or stuff. Seeing all of that in my mind's eye, that I actually see that product and being a successful product. And one of the ways to get there often is to model those that have done it. Mm-hmm. To see people who've done that which I want to do and walk like them, breathe like them, talk like them, you hold my body like them. And to if that's what a person needs to do, that process of modeling or matching somebody's own behavior will allow you to walk that same path, because we're all come from the same genetic structure ultimately. You know, we're all made of the same cells. We breathe the same air. We have the same building blocks. So who makes me and makes you you, that I should be able to do whatever it is you do if I do exactly like you did. Does that make sense?
That 100% makes sense.
My three ways of confronting fear is breathe, be in gratitude, and see yourself doing, accomplishing, being that thing that you want.
100%. And a good question for you, because I've seen this quite a few times with some of my friends where they have used that, where they've picked somebody like, say, a D Martini or a Tony Robbins or somebody like that, where they used as a model, which is great to help them kind of get out of that underdog, where they actually started to kind of get some traction on their own. And can you give me tips on, because sometimes what happens is people can, they almost start to then just copy, but that's actually not authentically who they are. Right. And so, do you have any tips on, you know, using someone else as a model to help get momentum going? And then once you get some momentum going, what are some ways that maybe you have in the past where you chisel down to find out who you are so that it can be a little bit more authentically you?
The story that I just shared about doing my first health talk, mm-hmm. I literally read a script.
Yeah.
And literally, I mean, I word for word, I memorized the damn thing, right?
Yeah.
And at the point that I no longer needed to think about the script is the first time that I actually give a talk, that the word just happened, right? I think that's true with every skill. If you're wanting to play tennis, you're taught how to hold a racket, how to stand, how to reach, how to do everything, and you watch other tennis players, you do it. The day that you're no longer thinking about it is the first day you really play tennis.
Right.
Same thing is true when you're learning any skill, you know, whether it be how to give a lecture or play tennis or any sport, any activity, dancing, whatever it is, the day that you have the ability to not think about it, where the action and the movement and the words and it all just happens is the first time that you actually have the ability to make something your own. Am I making sense?
That totally makes sense. That's also like adjusting too, I find, right? With adjusting.
Yeah. Stand this way, hold this way, push this. When you can leave, I talk about it moving from the right, from the left brain over to the right brain. You need to satisfy, you know, if the left brain is the logical, analytical, quantitative algorithms that we go through, and the right brain, the more intuitive, connected, appreciates holes, the whole picture. You need to dance. You need to move from the left brain to the right brain continuously. So the learning the technology, learning a procedure, learning a technique, learning a system is all left brain phenomena.
Yeah.
When you're able to move from the left brain into the right brain, where the left brain says, yeah, I got it. I figured it out. I know what it is. And it can step out of the way. It allows the degree of authenticity of who a person is to come through them. Mm-hmm. It's not to say sometimes you don't stay in your left brain and begin in a process there. This is adjusting. That there are times that we're just adjusting, connecting to people and knowing what to do. But there are times that we'll have to go into the left brain and say, okay, this is here and this is here and this is this indicator, this is that indicator. And you go through a rational judgment of logic and that algorithm inside your left brain. But at that point, right before you're going to do something to serve that person, you got to leave your left brain.
Yeah.
And fully engage with that person that you're there to serve. So how do you move from that? You continually do it. The more you do something, the more that you, if you, as you said, develop that neural pathway. Mm-hmm. And as you know, that neural pathway is developed in two ways. One is through the actual doing of it with the physiology. The other one is to be doing it in your mind. You're just seeing it within your mind's eye continuously. And both of them build the neurology. Both of them impact the physiology. We know that take a sports team, put them in a dark room, and have them watch a play done perfectly right over and over and over again, does as much benefit as it is getting on the field and pushing and shoving and doing the physical aspect of it. Both of them are necessary to develop the physiology. I think that's true with every skill, that you want to be doing it, modeling, mirroring somebody else until you can make it your own, but you also keep doing that within your mind's eye. And you can keep doing it over and over and over and over again. And the more that you build that neural pathway, as you said, the more that you're able to make it yours, because you're not thinking about it anymore. You don't need to go through the logical algorithm inside your brain.
100%. Well, that's really cool, because the next question I go to is now, Peter, now in 2017, how do you stay inspired now, and who inspires you? I know a lot of times when people first start, say use a chiropractor for example, and they come out, they go to seminars and they hang around mentors because they learn how to do things. And then as you learn how to do things, we, like you said, we go more to the right brain. So how does Dr. Peter, stay inspired, and do you still use mentors, and could you explain a little bit about how do you keep sharp on your game now?
I think in the past, my mentors were my gurus, the people who I saw speaking, lecturing, and they're still there. I still, those mentors still live there, whether they're dead or alive, inside my mind. There is a point in my life where I realized that we are not human doings. We are human beings. And that was a major shifting point. And maybe that goes back to your first question. Maybe that was when I realized what success was, is that I was a being and not a doing. We tend to define ourselves by things that we do, by what we accomplish, by the numbers in your bank account, or the number of visits, or the people you've served, or the number of employees you have, whatever they are, right? And although those things may have value, that was not as important as being the person that Peter wants to be. So what Peter does today, his mentors are the people who I see that are in a state of being. Mm-hmm. Yesterday there was a party at my beach house, and there was this absolutely luscious, delicious 6-year-old little girl who was in an absolutely amazing state of being as she was eating a dessert. And just to come into witness of that state of grace, of that magical moment as she was literally diving into this dessert, totally enraptured in that moment that nothing else mattered, that was her passion. That state of beingness is what I strive for. And who are my teachers in that? Is every person has a possibility of being there. Yeah. The person who walks into my practice and who gets off the table and shares with me an experience that happened at their job, performing an act or an action, or being there for somebody as they were taking their last breath on the planet. Whatever it was that you could just feel their soul in totally passionately existing in that moment. And those are my teachers. What is it that person does, says, is, acts, that allows them to be so passionate about whatever it is in that moment? Because that's what I strive for, because that's all we have is really the moment right now, to be in this moment. So it's less about the doingness as much as it more is about the beingness, to be totally there, connected in that moment. So the nice thing about that, my mentors and my teachers live everywhere.
Great.
What I do. I went up to breakfast this morning, and we were at a really, really busy breakfast place. And the woman who wound up serving us, my God, what a being of light, was just serving, totally celebrating the experience of being able to be a waitress and coming to witness of that and say, that's what I want. That's what I'm going to model. Or yesterday, the 6-year-old little girl, or seeing Dawn right now through digital means to say, man, this guy's thousands of miles away from me, but we're having this amazing conversation that other people are going to listen to. That is like, wow, it's impressive. And so that Peter today is getting in that space.
You know? It's all about finding beauty in the moment.
In that moment, right.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Well, in closing, I wonder if you had any like parting words of wisdom for maybe anybody out there who's listening that might be feeling like, you know, they're worried about people's expectations and worrying about everybody else and not being fulfilled because they're not spending enough time kind of figuring out what would be impactful or purposeful to them. Do you have any parting words of wisdom with your years of experience?
Sure. My parting words are, don't listen to anybody else. The wisdom already lives inside of us. I believe that we all have this amazing, magical capability of life inside of us. And somewhere locked in there is the not the answer, but the mechanism of you finding your authentic being, me finding my authentic being. It doesn't need to fit into anybody else's algorithm. It doesn't need to fit into anybody else's path. And that little girl, that little boy that lives inside of each person, I think we all know is there, and we're sometimes can't listen to him or her because of the external world. Those are the underdogs. That's the thing that inhibits the expression of the potential that resides inside of that person. There are going to be opportunities in your life, my life, that little girl, little boy can jump out and party however they're supposed to and express life the way they're supposed to. There will be books written, there'll be seminars given, there'll be people speaking that might inspire you, but ultimately the real inspiration is going to come when you can learn to love that little girl, little boy, and let him or her just go out and do the dance that he or she was meant to do. It doesn't come in an external thing, it comes from the inside out, and trust yourself that answer will always come through.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank Dr. Peter Vorkian from Boston, Massachusetts to, you know, impart some of your years of wisdom on the listeners and give them some tools. So
I think this is like the third or fourth time you've referred to this age thing.
Hey, it's wisdom.
I'm not that much older than you.
No, but it's wisdom, right? So we want to learn from the wisdom, right? The more years we have, especially too, like we talk about in the book, about shortening that refractory period, right? So when things go wrong, when you learn from it and move to the next level, the more years you do that, you accumulate a lot of wisdom, right? So I love you, Peter.
Love you, man. Thank you. Thank you for all you're doing, Don. You're making a powerful difference in the world. I really appreciate you, man. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And remember, everybody out there, crush the curse. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you receive value from this episode, please take some time to rate and review us on iTunes or your favorite place to listen to podcasts. If you know a fellow chiropractor that could benefit from this message, please share it with them. Because it's my goal to provide you with great content, please contact me if you have any questions at drdonmcdonald.com or find me on Facebook. I look forward to hearing from you. So until next time, Dr. Don out.